Opening the door, he saw Cynthia frantic with worry. He toppled into bed. When he woke up and dressed, he had no memory of the night before and couldn't understand why the heels of his new shoes were worn down. He went outside and looked around, but he couldn't find his car, so he called the police and reported it stolen. 2 days later, the police called to tell him that they'd found the car in a wealthy neighborhood in the Hollywood Hills. He went up to where they had found it, and memories of his night came back to him, carrying the ethereal quality of a nightmare. Cynthia pleaded with Louis to stop drinking. It did no good. The further Louis fell, the less he could hide it. Rick Applewhite noticed that he was manically germophobic, washing his hands over and over again, and each time scouring the faucet and handles on the sink. Some of Louis's friends spoke to him about his drinking, but their words had no impact. When Peyton Jordan saw Louis, he recognized that he was in trouble, but couldn't get him to talk about it. Pete, too, was worried about Louis, but knew only of his financial woes. He had no idea that Louis had slid into alcoholism or that he had hatched a wild scheme to kill a man. Cynthia was distraught over what her husband had become. In public, his behavior was frightening and embarrassing. In private, he was often prickly and harsh with her. She did her best to soothe him, to no avail. Once, while Louis was out, she painted their dreary kitchen with elaborate illustrations of vines and animals, hoping to surprise him. He didn't notice. Wounded and worried, Cynthia couldn't bring Louis back. Her pain became anger, and she and Louis had bitter fights. She slapped him and threw dishes at him. He grabbed her so forcefully that he left her bruised. Once he came home to find that she had run through a room, hurling everything breakable onto the floor. While Cynthia cooked dinner during a party on a friend's docked yacht, Louis was so snide to her, right in front of their friends, that she walked off the boat. He chased her down and grabbed her by the neck. She slapped his face and he let her go. She fled to his parents' house and he went home alone. Cynthia eventually came back, and the two struggled on together. His money gone, Louis had to tap a friend for a $1,000 loan, staking his Chevy convertible as collateral. The money ran out, another investment foundered, the loan came due, and Louis had to turn over his keys. When Louis was a small child, he had tripped and fallen on a flight of stairs while hurrying to school. He had gotten up, only to stumble and fall a second time, then a third. He had risen, convinced that God himself was tripping him. Now the same thought dwelt in him. God, he believed, was toying with him. When he heard preaching on the radio, he angrily turned it off. He forbade Cynthia from going to church. In the spring of 1948, Cynthia told Louis that she was pregnant. Louis was excited, but the prospect of more responsibility filled him with guilt and despair. In London that summer, Sweden's Henry Eriksson won the Olympic gold medal in the 1,500 meters. In Hollywood, Louis drank ever harder. No one could reach Louis because he had never really come home. In prison camp, he'd been beaten into dehumanized obedience to a world order in which the bird was absolute sovereign, and it was under this world order that he still lived. The bird had taken his dignity and left him feeling humiliated, ashamed, and powerless, and Louis believed that only the bird could restore him by suffering and dying in the grip of his hands. A once singularly hopeful man now believed that his only hope lay in murder. The paradox of vengefulness is that it makes men dependent upon those who have harmed them, believing that their release from pain will come only when they make their tormentors suffer. In seeking the bird's death to free himself, Louis had chained himself, once again, to his tyrant. During the war, the bird had been unwilling to let go of Louis. After the war, Louis was unable to let go of the bird. One night in late 1948, Louis lay in bed with Cynthia beside him. He descended into a dream, and the bird rose up over him. The belt unfurled, and Louis felt the buckle cracking into his head, pain like lightning over his temple. Around and around the belt whirled, lashing Louis's skull. Louis raised his hands to the bird's throat, his hands clenching around it. Now Louis was on top of the bird, and the two thrashed. There was a scream, perhaps Louis's, perhaps the bird's. Louis fought on, trying to crush the life out of the bird. Then everything began to alter. Louis, on his knees with the bird under him, looked down. The bird's shape shifted. Louis was straddling Cynthia's chest, his hands locked around her neck. Through her closing throat, she was screaming. Louis was strangling his pregnant wife. He let go and leapt off Cynthia. She recoiled, gasping, crying out. He sat in the dark beside her, horrified, his nightclothes heavy with sweat. The sheets were twisted into ropes around him. Little Cynthia Zamperini, nicknamed Sissy, was born 2 weeks after Christmas. Louis was so enraptured that he wouldn't let anyone else hold her, and did all the diapering himself. But she couldn't cleave him from alcoholism or his murderous obsession. In the sleepless stress of caring for a newborn, Louis and Cynthia fought constantly and furiously. When Cynthia's mother came to help, she wept at the sight of the apartment. Louis drank without restraint. One day Cynthia came home to find Louis gripping a squalling Sissy in his hands, shaking her. With a shriek, she pulled the baby away. Appalled at himself, Louis went on bender after bender. Cynthia had had enough. She called her father, and he sent her the money to go back to Miami Beach. She decided to file for divorce. Cynthia packed her things, took the baby, and walked out. Louis was alone. All he had left was his alcohol and his resentment, the emotion that, Jean Améry would write, nails every one of us onto the cross of his ruined past. On the other side of the world, early one evening in the fading days of 1948, Shizuka Watanabe sat on the lower floor of a two-story restaurant in Tokyo's Shinjuku district. Always coming back to the stooped figure drawing letters in the sand, Louis grew more and more angry and more spooked. "Every head bowed and every eye closed," said Graham, offering a traditional invitation to repentance, a declaration of faith and absolution. Louis grabbed Cynthia's arm, stood up, and bowled his way from the tent. Somewhere in the city, a siren began a low wail. The sound, rising and falling slowly, carried through the tent, picked up by the microphone that was recording the sermon. That night, Louis lay helpless as the belt whipped his head. The body that hunched over him was that of the bird. The face was that of the devil. Louis rose from his nightmares to find Cynthia there. All morning Sunday, she tried to coax him into seeing Graham again. Louis, angry and threatened, refused. For several hours, Cynthia and Louis argued. Exhausted by her persistence, Louis finally agreed to go, with one caveat. When Graham said every head bowed, every eye closed, they were leaving. Under the tent that night, Graham spoke of how the world was in an age of war, an age defined by persecution and suffering. "Why," Graham asked, "is God silent while good men suffer?" He began his answer by asking his audience to consider the evening sky. "If you look into the heavens tonight, on this beautiful California night, I see the stars and can see the footprints of God," he said. "I think to myself, my Father, my Heavenly Father, hung them there with a flaming fingertip and holds them there with the power of his omnipotent hand, and he runs the whole universe. And he's not too busy running the whole universe to count the hairs on my head and see a sparrow when it falls, because God is interested in me. God spoke in creation." Louis was winding tight. He remembered the day when he and Phil, slowly dying on the raft, had slid into the doldrums. Above, the sky had been a swirl of light. Below, The stilled ocean had mirrored the sky, its clarity broken only by a leaping fish. Awed to silence, forgetting his thirst and his hunger, forgetting that he was dying, Louis had known only gratitude. That day, he had believed that what lay around them was the work of infinitely broad, benevolent hands, a gift of compassion. In the years since, that thought had been lost. Graham went on. He spoke of God reaching into the world through miracles and the intangible blessings that give men the strength to outlast their sorrows. God works miracles one after another, he said. God says, if you suffer, I'll give you the grace to go forward. Louis found himself thinking of the moment at which he had woken in the sinking hull of Green Hornet. The wires that had trapped him a moment earlier, now, inexplicably, gone. And he remembered the Japanese bomber swooping over the rafts, riddling them with bullets, and yet not a single bullet had struck him, Phil, or Mac. He had fallen into unbearably cruel worlds, and yet he had borne them. When he turned these memories in his mind, the only explanation he could find was one in which the impossible was possible. What God asks of men, said Graham, is faith. His invisibility is the truest test of that faith. To know who sees him, God makes himself unseen. Louis shone with sweat. He felt accused, cornered, pressed by a frantic urge to flee. As Graham asked for heads to bow and eyes to close, Louis stood abruptly and rushed for the street, towing Cynthia behind him. Nobody leaving, said Graham. You can leave while I'm preaching, but not now. Everybody is still and quiet, every head bowed, every eye closed. He asked the faithful to come forward. Louis pushed past the congregants in his row, charging for the exit. His mind was tumbling. He felt enraged, violent, on the edge of explosion. He wanted to hit someone. As he reached the aisle, he stopped. Cynthia, the rows of bowed heads, the sawdust underfoot, the tent around him, all disappeared. A memory long beaten back, the memory from which he had run the evening before, was upon him. Louis was on the raft. There was gentle Phil crumpled up before him, Mac's breathing skeleton, endless ocean stretching away in every direction, the sun lying over them, the cunning bodies of the sharks waiting, circling. He was a body on a raft, dying of thirst. He felt words whisper from his swollen lips. It was a promise thrown at heaven, a promise he had not kept, a promise he had allowed himself to forget until just this instant. If you will save me, I will serve you forever. And then, standing under a circus tent on a clear night in downtown Los Angeles, Louis felt rain falling. It was the last flashback he would ever have. Louis let go of Cynthia and turned toward Graham. He felt supremely alive. He began walking. This is it, said Graham. God has spoken to you. You come on. Cynthia kept her eyes on Louis all the way home. When they entered the apartment, Louis went straight to his cache of liquor. It was the time of night when the need usually took hold of him, but for the first time in years, Louis had no desire to drink. He carried the bottles to the kitchen sink, opened them, and poured their contents into the drain. Then he hurried through the apartment, gathering packs of cigarettes, a secret stash of girly magazines, everything that was part of his ruined years. He heaved it all down the trash chute. In the morning, he woke feeling cleansed. For the first time in 5 years, the bird hadn't come into his dreams. The bird would never come again. Louis dug out the Bible that had been issued to him by the Air Corps and mailed home to his mother when he was believed dead. He walked in Barnsdall Park, where he and Cynthia had gone in better days, and where Cynthia had gone alone when he'd been on his benders. He found a spot under a tree, sat down, and began reading. Resting in the shade and the stillness, Louis felt profound peace. When he thought of his history, what resonated with him now was not all that he had suffered, but the divine love that he believed had intervened to save him. He was not the worthless, broken, forsaken man that the bird had striven to make of him. In a single silent moment, his rage, his fear, his humiliation and helplessness had fallen away. That morning, he believed, he was a new creation. Softly, he wept.